Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools.
I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com, designed for work.
I remember speaking to an investor who had invested in a lot of fintech companies and had been on the board of some of the best known payment companies. I had my usual intro that I usually go in explaining how payment economics works. And so for him, I said, hey, I don't need to go into the payments like 101 piece, right? And he was like, no, I got this. 2 minutes in, you can usually read the audience, right? When you're doing a pitch and you're like, oh, this is not going well. You know, it was like one of those deer in the headlights moments. And you're like, hey, you're not following what I'm saying. And he's like, nope.
Payments are often a black box, with most people merely observing money moving in and out of their accounts, seemingly by magic. Today's guest has a habit of explaining how the payment ecosystem works on every opportunity he gets.
If you can pitch someone in a bar after a few drinks and make payments sound interesting, you probably, you know, can pitch anything.
Leveraging this expertise, Richie Serna founded Phoenix, a fintech that started as a payments infrastructure startup and gradually expanded into facilitating and processing payments. To date, Phoenix has raised over $130 million and has processed tens of billions of dollars in payments. Phoenix built its tech stack from scratch, which allows it to connect directly with any card network in the US market, where four payment processors have over 80% of the entire market share with technology from the 90s. Today, Rich and I talked about all things payments.
I think it's also one of those areas that you interact with this product three or four times per day, and most people take it for granted, right? It's so ubiquitous that you don't even think about the fact that you can swipe something, and then within seconds, this transaction gets processed.
The product insights he gained from the industry history.
It was really hard for me in the first, you know, few years of payments to understand like why everything was so messed up, and yet why they had such a strong position in the market. For us, what it really showed us was there's really three things that kind of like happened.
Phoenix's business model evolution from enabling vertical SaaS to becoming a payment processor, and how payments will shape the future of the software.
If Phoenix becomes the AWS of fintech,
when?
This conversation was a masterclass in the payments industry, and I hope you enjoy it.
Richie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. No, very happy to have you. Thanks for taking the time. It's one of our first shows in person, so we're excited to take advantage of living in San Francisco to host incredible people like yourself. And let's start with something that I've heard you talk about, which is that your girlfriend doesn't like you talking about payments whenever you go out with your friends. Could you explain payments to us with the napkin that I've heard you talk about? You mind you have the napkin?
I don't have a napkin with me, but I do see your piece of paper there and it's calling out to me.
Explain like that picture of the payments ecosystem in that napkin and where Phoenix fits into this picture.
I think in general, anytime like you start your company, you're going to be super passionate about like that particular subject or area. And when you try to explain payments in general, it's not the most riveting subject. And I think it's also one of those areas that you interact with this product three or four times per day. And most people take it for granted, right? It's so ubiquitous that you don't even think about the fact that you can swipe something and then within seconds, this transaction gets processed. And like when you really peel back to understand the infrastructure that goes behind it, the complexity that makes this seem so seamless of an experience, it's incredibly exciting to understand. And so I think one of the things that I've found over time is that when you try to explain something and you show people slides are the worst way that you can possibly communicate anything. There's actually a very like powerful element to whiteboarding out a concept, because one of the things that you end up seeing is like, I could show you a slide and it'll have like eight different blocks that represent each part of that ecosystem and each part of the sort of like payment stack that we like to talk about. And you'll just look at them and you'll gloss it over. You'll try to interpret what's on the slide rather than listening to me. And so when you have a whiteboard or a napkin and you can draw out each piece of that payment stack, people follow your entire logic, right? And so you can just have this little simple napkin and you can explain first, like, hey, you know, I'm going to explain to you how a transaction works, right? We'll start off with the credit card networks because everybody knows Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Discover. You've heard of those brands. Exactly. And you draw that in the middle. And then you share that there's two sides of each transaction. You have the seller and then you have the buyer, and you draw each of those out. And you say, first, let's start off with the buyer or the cardholder. And you explain that there's actually two elements on that side as well. There's something like a processor and another thing as a bank. And so then you explain what the processor is. The processor is the technology layer that connects the credit card networks to the banks. And then you explain what the bank actually does. The bank is saying, hey, does Enzo have a good enough credit score and a good enough income to get a $10,000 credit limit? Yes, they issue out the card. And in return for that, they make a piece of money, right? Like if you have a $100 transaction, usually the seller, say it's like Nike selling you a pair of shoes, they don't get all $100 from that payment. They get the $100 less 2.9% for payment processing.
The interchange rate.
Exactly. And so most people think that Visa and MasterCard are the ones making most of this economics. They're actually only making maybe 0.2%. It's the issuing bank, the person who's taking that risk. If you don't pay back that credit card, they're making about 175 basis points or 1.75%. And so you kind of have now drawn out, here are the players on one side of the transaction. Then you go to the other side and you explain, here are the providers on the issuing or on the acquiring side. That's the party who deals with the merchant. And you explain in each of these concepts, usually examples that are tangible to them, right? When you explain like what is the purpose of a bank on the merchant side, it's to underwrite the risk of the merchant or Nike. And so why is there any risk with Nike in a transaction? Oftentimes you'll think to yourself, like there doesn't seem like there's a lot of risk. For something like Nike, there honestly isn't. The example I like to use is Fyre Festival. Do you remember Fyre Festival? It's this music festival that happened, I think it was out in like the Caribbean or something like that. They sold $25 million worth of tickets, and it ended up being this massive fraud. And so that festival was a business. They went bankrupt. All the people who bought those tickets, they all got their money back. And so once that business was bankrupt, it fell onto their acquiring bank to take on that risk and those financial losses. And so right now, I'm obviously explaining how I draw out each of those and each of those steps. But when you kind of bring together a very like esoteric, very jargon heavy concept, and you can break it down into little slivers with real world examples that help you understand, then people kind of like light up, right? And so if you can pitch someone in a bar after a few drinks and make payments sound interesting, you probably, you know, can pitch anything. So
let's be real. Like, have you used that technique to pitch an investor?
For
talent?
Oh yeah. So the reason why I started like drawing all these things out, I worked at a previous payment startup. It was my first startup that I ever worked at. I was an engineer there. And we were like maybe like a 15, 20 person startup. And I could not understand payments for the life of me. Like I started a payment company, but it took me so long to understand how all these things work. And it's so jargon heavy. And there's so many pieces that don't seem to make sense. So just for like a very simple example, I couldn't for the life of me understand the connection between a debit and credit card, and debits and credits and accounting, and then the ACH debits and credit system. So I was like, there has to be this connection. There's not. And so there's like a lot of these concepts that you hear that are like, you know, kind of mind melting, and like, why did these? And
for the average person, they sound similar.
Yeah. And like, I like to make connections, and I was trying to force these connections that didn't, make all that much sense. And I don't know that we actually spent a lot of time training people in the payments world back then. And they just kind of threw you in the deep end and said, hey, here's your laptop, go manage like engineering support. And you're like, okay. And then, so that was sort of my first experience. And so we started Phoenix. I made it a point to spend a lot of time teaching every single person. So till this day, I lead every single onboarding session at all Phoenix to teach people payments. And so it's about like a 3 to 4 hour like session. And it's usually a lot of like whiteboarding that's a part of that. And so I'll whiteboard out the payments ecosystem. I'll whiteboard money flows and money movement so people can understand when you swipe that card, how does money actually move behind the scenes?
This is happening in person.
In person, always. Yeah, you got to do it in person. Think about like,
that's a lot of time putting into that onboarding and explaining people
yeah,
how
absolutely.
Payments work.
And if you think about how much hours of confusion and lost time can be created, because I know how much time I probably wasted trying to make sense of this, it pays dividends, right? And one of the things we take a lot of pride in is kind of this idea that like the folks at Phoenix are payment geeks, right? And so people like really like to kind of geek out and nerd out on these things. And so when you give people a deeper understanding of how things work, it allows them to be much more curious. It allows them to ask more questions. I even start off every single onboarding session saying, this is going to be painful and this is going to be confusing, right? And like, you have to ask questions if you don't get it. And you're going to have to ask questions not once, not twice, three, four, how many times it takes you, ask it over and over and over again. Because if I had these questions and I felt, you know, this sense of like confusion, I know that everybody else is as well. And so even today, no matter what function it is at the company, if it's marketing, if it's sales, if it's payment operations and compliance, I'm one of the first person to throw up my hand and say, what does that mean? What is that term, right? Because oftentimes people actually make up a lot of terms. And so it's always hard to tell, is that like an industry standard term? Is that a company specific term? Is that a term that this person just made up to kind of sound smart? Is it something that, you know? And so it's almost like this game of Babel that happens, but for tech, you know, when you kind of create that environment where everybody is kind of learning together and it's encouraged to ask questions, creates a much safer psychological safety and environment that encourages that. But back to like, you know, using that whole framework, when we did our Series A pitch, I remember speaking to an investor who had invested in a lot of fintech companies and had been on the board of some of the best known payment companies. I had my usual intro that I usually go in explaining how payment economics works. And so for him, I said, hey, I don't need to go into the payments like 101 piece, right? And he was like, no, I got this. And 2 minutes in, you can usually read the audience, right? When you're doing a pitch and you're like, oh, this is not going well, you know? It was like one of those deer in the headlights moments. And you're like, hey, you're not following what I'm saying. And he's like, nope. And I was like, all right. And I was like, do you have a whiteboard? And kind of looked at me confused. And he's like, sure. And so they call in, bring in a whiteboard, we wheel it in. I draw it out. And he's like, wow, I had no idea that's how my company made money. And it sounds funny, but like, you know, when you ask, he's like, hey, I'll be honest with you. That company just went up and to the right. That's all that I knew. And so from that moment on, no matter, you know, how deep of experts in payments or fintech they were, I would take that like extra, you know, 3 to 5 minutes up front and explain the unit economics and the players of this ecosystem, and it hooked them and also helped them understand why what we were doing was differentiated, mm-hmm. how the ecosystem worked. If you look even today at a lot of our content marketing, it's very education-based to help people understand.
I've seen it. I also learned myself a lot of about payments, but by preparing this interview.
Yeah. Now you're hooked. Now everywhere you go, you're going to be looking at these devices in the store. You're like, is that Ingenico? Is that Pax? Is that Verifone? Who is that? Yeah.
Well, I also became a payment geek this last week.
So. Yeah, you're one of us now.
So speaking of geeking about payments, I've heard you talk about this book by Glenbrook Partners on the history of payments. Yeah. Basically, why payment seems very convoluted, as you just explained. And a lot of things don't seem to make sense until you understand them in the context of history.
Yeah.
And I believe this is true for many industries. Like understanding the history of an industry, I think, gives you an edge.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, are there any insights, ideas, concepts that you brought to the Phoenix product thanks to understanding the history of the industry?
Oh, absolutely. I think in anything, whether it's, you know, startups, tech, your specific industry, you got to be a student of the specific space and understand the history, because typically there is a method to the madness, right? There is a reason why these things happened. In hindsight, they may not have been the most optimal or efficient decisions that people came about, but there is a reason why, you know, these things came about. And so in the world of payments specifically, when you look today, there's probably about like 5 payment processors in the US who own about 80% of the entire market share. And so we worked in payments about 10 years ago, and a lot of the things that we were working on were so broken, so fragmented, that it was really hard for me in the first, you know, few years of payments to understand like why everything was so messed up, and yet why they had such a strong position in the market. And so for us, what it really showed us was there's really 3 things that kind of like happened in the history of payments. One, most of those payment processors that own the big market share, they were all built in the pre-internet era through technology. And I'll explain in a few why that's so important. The second part was that most of these payment processors didn't grow through R&D investment. They grew through M&A acquisitions. And the third part was that as these two things kind of came about, the pre-internet technology and the M&A growth, to kind of solve for the really antiquated technology, people just started building layers and layers on top of each other, and it kind of exacerbated a lot of the underlying issues. And so now what you end up seeing is that there's a tremendous amount of outages and downtime. There's a lack of data transparency. There are bloated costs. There are just very slow development cycles. You'll actually see that Visa and MasterCard are actually quite innovative and roll out new technology all the time. But the layer that sits between the credit card networks and the merchants is like the slowest part of innovation and development. It takes them quite literally like 17 to 18 hours for their test suites to run.
Wow.
So if you're an engineer and you commit code, you got to come back tomorrow to see if your code worked. You're not going to be able to code at the same pace as us. The pre-internet era, like technology, right? Do you know when Visa was created?
No.
50s and 60s. When did the internet become like broadly commercially available?
In 2000s.
So like 1997-ish, around then. Most of the payment systems that exist today were built in the early 90s or even the 80s. So they weren't built for e-commerce. They weren't built for the app ecosystem and marketplaces. It's kind of weird to think about, but like these payment systems were designed for the local coffee shop and retailer. Now, if you think about what happened after the app ecosystem, right, the iPhone gets introduced in like 2007, you have Airbnb, you have Uber. In those payment flows, you have many buyers, a web app like Airbnb and Uber, and then you have many sellers. So you're now taking money in from multiple parties and you're paying them out to multiple sellers. That fund flow, the many-to-many relationship, it doesn't exist in the real world. Think about it. What real world like example without technology that ever exists? It doesn't. They couldn't support that flow. And it sounds like very simple, but Uber had to build out a 400-person payment engineering team just dedicated to that, right? Airbnb has 170 people dedicated to their payment team. So it gives you a sense of how complex trying to retrofit these antiquated systems for this unique fund flow. And the other part, they were all AWS, came about 2006, 2007. So all of these payment systems that exist today, they're all on-premise solutions. Square, a few weeks ago, had a 12-hour outage, meaning you could not process payments for 12 straight hours, right? You talk to a lot of the payment processors today, their CTOs, their CPOs, the next 5 to 10 years is just how do they take these on-premise solutions and get them to be scalable by moving to the cloud? There's not going to be any innovation coming from that. So that's one. Second part I mentioned is the M&A activity. And so basically what you see is that most of the payment processors that exist today, they're like 12 to 15 different companies smashed together. Because Wall Street said, hey, if you take these two companies, you bring them together, you know, you're going to be able to better multiple, like you're going to get cost savings, you're going to get all these synergies that come about. But from a technology perspective, you can't just smash together two backend systems. You can't smash together two APIs. That's not how technology
works. Embedded bug in theory doesn't replicate to the world.
No, right? And so these companies now have to maintain 15 different platforms with 15 different backend languages, 15 different databases, 15 different API schemas and specs. And so if you wanted to, we were talking about a vertical SaaS payments before this. If you wanted to offer vertical SaaS payments both online and in-store, right? That's what they call it, omni-channel payments. You have to connect into one system, which spun out of a bank back in like 08.
So basically two companies.
Two companies. They do not communicate. And so every one of these major payment processors has this term omni-channel all over their website. The reality is they don't tell you. It's like, okay, but you still got to connect into two different systems. Someone was telling me that at Worldpay, they only have four companies who actually successfully brought those two disparate systems together. It's that hard to be able to do. Right. And so the last part is that like people just keep building layers and layers on top of each other. So you think about like Stripe and Square, they originally got started off as sort of these thin clients and services built on top of these legacy providers. And so you take this system, you add more and more layers, it gets either more expensive. There's less data transparency. There's more outages. There's more risk vectors that are there. There's less innovation. So it's very fascinating to kind of see how this came about. And so going back to like, why is that so important? That really influenced how we thought architecturally about how to build our platform. It influenced how we designed. It influenced how we pitched. It influenced how we even sell in the sales process. Because when you go in the sales process and everybody's websites look the same, how do you help people understand that not all APIs are created equal, right? You can say a bunch of marketing jargon, or you can help them understand like, hey, this is what it really is behind the scenes.
That's incredible. I find that
deeply fascinating because it's like you have like these very core insights run from the scratch, yeah. Right? And you don't, like, I guess, wasted time building things that otherwise you would have said, hey, actually, after a couple of years, this doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Because you already knew the history of the industry, so you could save that time. I mean, obviously, developer hours, funding, etc. Connecting history with the infrastructure players in the fintech industry. I've heard you talk about Plaid, yeah. Marqeta. Have you learned anything about studying those players who, I guess, at least from what I understand, are the first movers in this new like infrastructure wave of fintech?
Oh, yeah.
I know Zach and Jason, the two founders of both these companies and incredible founders who've done some incredible things as well. I think one of the things that is an obvious sort of takeaway is that innovation comes from iteration, right? Like if you think about someone like Marqeta, they probably had tried, and you can read about this on Forbes, maybe four or five different product strategies and companies. It didn't start off as a credit card issuing as a service provider. I think originally it was supposed to be kind of like a Groupon on like a card-based product. And they went through, I think they tried to roll out like the Facebook developer or the Facebook branded credit card or debit card. And they realized like, hey, we built this like really cool technology for issuing cards. Why don't we just make that our whole business? And that took off. And now you see that almost every single retailer in the country has some sort of debit card, credit card product that they've tied to it, which has been really exciting. I think when you think about Plaid and the other folks that are out there, just understanding that even when you're rethinking a critical part of the financial services sector, the legacy providers are a core part of that ecosystem. You can't just start over from scratch, right? They're critical ecosystem partners that you have to play well with that can really enable the business as well and do want to do well by everyone. So I think those are some of the critical lessons. I think the other part is that fintech just takes longer than most people think, right? You think about a lot of like SaaS-based businesses and, you know,
time to market.
I mean, like the typical prototype takes like 2.5 to 3 years just to get out. Right. If you want to store credit cards and become, you have to be PCI compliant, which is on average $250,000 and takes the average company 2 to 3 years before you can get that certification in play. I think those are things that help you contextualize. They help you think about how to strategize. They help you think about capital allocation because you have to make your dollars go further. Yeah. Yeah. So I think those are all critical lessons that you pick up from those companies and other folks in the fintech infrastructure space.
That last point is very interesting point, the capital allocation one, mm-hmm. because I understand you guys struggled a lot to raise your first round for Phoenix. So how do you think about, like, I guess, a minimum capital requirement to start a fintech today, given these constraints or situations you've described?
Yeah, so this is like back in 2017.
Probably has changed, but...
Yeah. So actually, I mean, fintech as a whole is now like this very hot space or has been for the last few years. When I first got into payments, this is back in 2013, the first payment startup that I worked at, we struggled for well over a year to raise our Series A. And we were neck and neck with Stripe at the time. And so I remember talking to one of our lawyers about, hey, why are we struggling to raise? We have, you know, a few hundred marketplaces. If you look at Hacker News, you know, it's always us versus Stripe. Like we're beating them consistently. We clearly have a better product. And what he shared was, you know, if you think about fintech back in 2013, and you look back on the history of startups, how many fintech companies had gone public? How many fintech companies had had massive exits? The last big one was like, yeah, PayPal back in 2002 for a little bit under like $2 billion. Yeah. There are still so many barriers for people to be successful that fintech as a whole hadn't really been proven out. Then you saw, you know, Stripe, Marqeta, Plaid, and a bunch of other companies really start to change that entire narrative, and a lot more capital started flowing in. And so this is 2017 when we were raising our seed. It probably took us like 6 to 9 months. I probably did like a few hundred pitches. And this is the first time that...
Despite having some very relevant experience on balance. Yeah. It's not like you were an outsider coming into this new payments industry. You already had some very deep expertise.
Yeah, we were definitely... I mean, we were the pioneers of marketplace payments and SaaS payments at the time. And Stripe Connect, which is now their sort of like crown jewel in that space, that was a copycat of what we had built. And so we did a lot of really incredible, innovative things out there. But the narrative at the time was, I think crypto or Bitcoin specifically had just hit $10,000 for the first time ever. And so every VC that I would pitch would say, isn't Bitcoin just going to like destroy Visa and MasterCard? And then again, going back to that history of like understanding how Visa and MasterCard came about and understanding why that was such a silly question, at least not something that's going to happen in our lifetime and in the breadth and the extent of what it would take to create this type of global network, that was kind of what we were going up against. And so we were able to get some incredible investors to back us. Homebrew, Sacha Patel over there, who was very early on at Plaid and Chime and others, took a bet on us. Visa also invested. They were little known Visa, you know. They were very excited what we were doing. Precursor, Act One, a number of great investors who got involved then. And so we raised a $2 million seed round. And we knew that from that point, it was probably going to take us like 2 to 2.5 years for us to be able to build out that sort of product maturity to allow us to hit the revenue threshold for a Series A. And typically, each round, Series A, seed, Series A specifically, you're either doing like between $1 to $2 million in revenue at least for you even to be able to play ball at that level. And so we knew that, hey, you have $2 million to build something that typically takes, you know, as I mentioned, just to store credit cards, $250,000. So that's wiped away, right? And so you think about that, the insurance policies, what an average engineering salary looks like. And so very early on, we basically said, hey, for all of our first employees, we're going to put a salary cap in place.
Okay.
Right. And it's not going to be, you know, you could definitely make way more money at Google. You can make more money other places, but like, this is the line we have to draw in the sand for us to be able to hit that mark. And we were very generous with our equity packages as well, because we said, hey, you're going to take a bigger risk on us. We want you to get a bit bigger part of that pie and that reward as well. And so I think that was what we were very disciplined about. And even the way that we thought about budget allocation was like each week is TTL, time to life, right? And so you basically have like 2 years. So you break down 2 years by a week. What are you actually spending as a part of your lifeline? And it really helps contextualize things in terms of how you're going to place your bets, where you're going to invest your capital, and just creates that sense of urgency because, you know, a quarter goes by really quick.
It's interesting because that level of cash flow management is not something you see on early stage startup, right? It's usually reserved for the more big corporates that usually handle, hundreds of people team for treasury and accounting and stuff. But it's very interesting. So going back to the history of payments, you guys started as an API, then evolved into payment facilitator, and just recently became a payment processor, right? And going back to all the stacks you explained before, why did it make sense to start with a payment facilitator and then expand into becoming a payment processor? Was that the plan from the get-go?
Yeah.
Or what evolved or what changed in the process that made you think, okay, the right path is to become a payment processor?
Yeah. So having studied a number of like really great payment stories, companies like Adyen and Checkout, and understanding why were they one of the very few companies and payment companies in the world that could accept in multiple countries via one API. Mm-hmm. We kind of just like, we started looking at a lot of other providers and typically if you're a US-based payment processor, you can't also accept payments in the UK or the EU. Your bank sponsorship is very much structured to your local domicile. And so when we started thinking about like, hey, why are they able to do that? And if we were to actually go and say, we're going to integrate into the US-based payment processor at Moneris in Canada, another, you know, business in the UK and EU, that would probably take us like 15 to 20 years. And then like the technical overhead of having to manage each of those integrations, the feature disparity between each of those platforms would be incredibly hard to get around. We kind of peeled back what Adyen had done, and they basically had these direct connections into Visa, MasterCard, Amex, and Discover, and that allowed them then to find local banking partners. So simplified the lift over time. It took them a lot longer to get there though. And so most people had never heard of like Adyen until the last like 3 to 4 years, but they've been around since like 2006. It took them a really long time to get there, and they had to be very disciplined about how they built their platform. And so when we kind of like understood some of those dynamics, started thinking about our own strategy and how we would get there. And so it was always part of our long-term vision. In fact, we actually have a 10-year plan with 8 milestones of how we were going to achieve our vision. A big part of that is really building the global operating system for fintech, right? Our goal is to make it as easy as possible for you to be able to consume as a vertical SaaS company or a software company, any of the suite of products and services that you typically get from a commercial bank, all from one single API. And so you can't go after a bold vision like that from day one and just go after the big pie, right? You have to start very methodically and execute against that. We also understood that for you to be able to become a payment processor, you can't just go up to Visa and MasterCard and say, hey, I want to connect into your proprietary systems. For Visa, it's $250,000 integration fee. And if you don't get it done within a certain amount of time, it's $50,000 per month that you get penalized. For Amex, you have to be doing $250 million in volume per year before they'll even entertain it. There's multi-million dollar capital reserves. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars per year in insurance policies that you have to have. You have to have a head of like payment operations, anti-money laundering programs, you know, very well.
So it's basically not feasible for an early stage startup.
Not possible. Not possible. And so you learn that. You're like, all right, this is going to be a long-term investment. And I think that's honestly true for, it should be true for anybody who's starting a company. Is like, hey, if things go well, I'm going to be doing this at least for the next like 15 to 20 years. That's definitely true for fintech and payments. And so we've always taken a very long-term horizon view of how we were going to get there. And so it was more of an inevitability and just how to kind of navigate to that endpoint.
I'd love now to navigate into the, I guess this connection of Phoenix to the vertical SaaS industry or space itself. You guys started, I guess, Phoenix was probably one of the protagonists of riding this vertical SaaS wave that we've seen in the US for the last, probably 5-10 years, as it's become like a hot category in the startup and investment market. I guess at its core, like, what are the benefits of software providers offering payment capabilities to their clients? Like, why in your eyes it's so beneficial to their users? And not because I think from a revenue perspective, it makes sense. Yeah, you can take, yeah. I mean, some percentage points out of these transactions as a vertical SaaS. Oh, amazing. I'm going to get revenue out of this transaction volume that I'm already seeing pass through my platform. But I guess for their end customer, why it's so beneficial?
Yeah, it's really two things. Payments are profit. Payments are the product. Like, when you think about what someone like a Toast has been able to create, and so for folks who don't know, Toast is a vertical SaaS platform for restaurants. So if you run a restaurant and you go to a restaurant here in San Francisco or likely anywhere here in the country, most of what operates the day-to-day services and operations of that restaurant are provided by Toast. So they do like the order management, the seating arrangements. They even do payroll for the folks who work at the restaurant, and they will give away the
20 features.
It's wild. Yeah, it's really cool. And they give away the software now entirely for free to the restaurant, and they purely monetize basically on the payment. So every single time you buy something from the restaurant, from the bar, they're making the economics that typically a payment processor would make. And so the way to kind of think about them is that they are a purpose-built version of Square. They're Square for restaurants. And so the reason why you end up seeing that so many of these vertical SaaS companies get into payments and into other financial services is that vertical SaaS is inherently a niche approach, right? You're saying, I'm not going to go after every single, you know, potential customer in the country. I'm only going to sell to gyms. I'm only going to sell to restaurants. I'm only going to sell to plumbers or something else. Yeah. And I'm going to charge them $100 to $200 per month for that software. And so when you do the math on the TAM, the total addressable market, it ends up being rather limiting. If you can charge a gym $2,000 per year for the software, and there's tens of thousands of gyms, maybe if you got 100% of every single gym, you would build a $1 billion company. That's tough to kind of get that kind of a market saturation and capture everything that way. It's much easier though to say, hey, we're going to layer in payments, and now we'll take 2.9% of every single yoga mat, every single yoga class that they sell. And now you've doubled or even tripled your total addressable market because you have a new revenue stream that's coming in. And then it's not just that you have a new revenue stream, that's a much stickier product. And it's a much better business experience because now you don't have one reporting dashboard for payments, one reporting dashboard for your gym software management. Everything is completely reconciled in real time. You go to one vendor, it works out of the box. It's just a better overall experience. So there's a tremendous amount of benefits for those merchants, sellers, and even for the consumers as well.
Do you think, because most of these industries you described tend to be dominated by small businesses. And it makes sense. Like small businesses, when you talk to an SMB owner, they will tell you, I don't want to have 4 software providers. I just want, if I can get one that covers everything,
yeah,
they love it. Is there a point in which these companies grow, or you go to more like, I guess, industries that are much more concentrated into a few players where that play doesn't necessarily work as well?
There certainly are. I mean, I think you saw like a few years back, like Subway ended up building their own like payment systems for like their particular like franchises. But there's still a tremendous amount of like opportunities, right? Like even some of the larger gym franchises still get their payments and their software from these vertical SaaS providers. Like, their expertise is running gyms. Their expertise is not hiring engineers to be able to do that. And so like, it's just not part of their core competency.
Speaking of core competency, I'm going to read a quote that I heard on a previous interview. You said, Stripe and Braintree are like iOS. You are forced to use their ecosystem. Phoenix is more like Android, where, I mean, you can provide more configuration, control, and options. I found that quote interesting because iOS is probably the most desirable business model in the world. I mean, you get 30% cut out of everything people do.
Yeah.
Everybody hates you, but you still, you still do it. And the user, the average use end user is happy with iOS. Like, I think merchants hate iOS. I'm not sure if...
Who's the biggest player in the world, iOS or Android?
Android,
there you go.
Yeah, that's a good point. So why take the opposite positioning? But more importantly, why does this configurability make sense for the software providers?
I think one thing, payments is not selling to a consumer, right? Payments is selling to a business that is really thinking about the payments experience as a differentiator. I think especially based on the type of use case that we're solving for, we sell to every part of like the payments ecosystem. So if you're an online retailer, if you're an in-store merchant, if you're just using us for payouts, we can do that too. But when it specifically comes to vertical SaaS payments and marketplaces, a big part of their differentiation comes to their device strategy. The device that works in the restaurant is not the same device that's going to work for the plumber who's going out to fix, you know, some plumbing. It's not the same device that's going to work in a number of different areas, like the price point, the form factor, those things all matter. And so if you work with someone like Stripe, they actually bought a hardware provider called BBPOS, and they force everyone to use their three devices.
Okay.
Whereas for us, we actually partner with a number of different hardware providers out there in the ecosystem, Pax, Ingenico, Sumni, Verifone, and it's up to our customers to figure out, hey, what's the right price point and the right form factor that works specifically for their industry. People don't want to be forced to have to use those devices. They want that optionality.
Okay.
It also comes down to the back office payment operations, right? When you think about vertical SaaS companies, the developer experience is one part of it, and it's an important part of it, but it's really the back office team members. It's the head of risk, it's the head of compliance, it's the head of support. You were mentioning how, you know, a lot of these SMBs are managed by these single SaaS platforms. Well, each one of those SMBs, they have their own accounting systems. They have their own reconciliation processes. And so they want to be paid out. Some want to get paid out daily. Some want to get paid out weekly. Some want to get paid out monthly. Some want net payouts. Some want gross payouts. Some want interchange plus pricing. Some want the simplicity of a blended rate pricing. And so giving them that control is really meeting our customers and our customers' customers where they're at.
Yeah, there's a lot of business logic that goes behind how you design the payment experience that you need to give, I guess, a toolkit to your customers to be able to give that to your own customers.
I mean, think about like tax systems and tax software for businesses, right? You can't use TurboTax for your business. You might be able to use that and get started off if you're just like selling at your local farmer market. But very quickly, if you're running a serious business, it breaks. It does not work, right? And that's exactly what we see for a lot of our customers as well, who leave other, you know, vendors and come over to Phoenix because they want more of that control, because they don't want to have to rearrange their business to fit the constraints of something that's overly simplified and overly abstracted.
So speaking of this payment experience, your software provider clients don't only want to offer payments to customers. There's a lot of things, and I think you've talked about a lot about Toast, Mindbody, which I think are great examples of software providers that embedded payments, but then even like credit, I mean, I guess credit cards, loans, working capital, just financial products in general. I wonder if, does that mean that as you want to enable these software providers to offer more financial services to your customers, does Phoenix plan to start building infrastructure not only for payments, but for other, let's say, for credits, for loan, for credit cards, etc.? And if so, I'm curious about how are you thinking about the sequencing of those newer products that you would launch?
Yeah, absolutely. So I touched on a little bit on what our company vision is, to build the global operating system for fintech. And we say fintech and not payments, because we do have bigger ambitions and we want to be able to support our customers in more than just this area, because typically it's a few chapters that these types of vertical SaaS companies follow. But they usually follow it quite sequentially. They don't go immediately into lending. They usually go into payments first, and then after that, it's either lending or issuing. And so if you take a look at, like, for example, like the Wells Fargo landing page, you'll see like all the different products that Wells Fargo offers. If you look at like their commercial banking offering, those are the services that we eventually want to be able to offer and make them consumable. The bank will always exist, right? But how do we allow our customers to embed those solutions into their platform? That's really our role. And so we absolutely want to do that. The question always comes down to, do you want to go broad in your product suite or do you want to really go deep? And for us, we've always thought about, you know, most of our customers usually will focus on going live here, not just in the US, but then they want to go to Canada, UK, EU, Australia, New Zealand. It's typically like the English speaking countries plus like Europe is usually their kind of playbook that they follow. And so helping us unlock those parts of the business is most important for us now. And then helping them after that add in other products is more important to us and to our customers as well.
So you're thinking first about geographical coverage. Yeah. Before going expanding the product suite.
Yeah, I think it's, you look at something like lending. Lending, yes, it's fintech, but it's a very different part of the fintech ecosystem with a very different set of rules. And I think oftentimes companies can get way too bloated and the complexity of layering that in is probably too much for a lot of early stage startups. And so even going international, every single country we go into has different compliance and underwriting requirements, different money service business registrations. And so that can take a lot of time. And so we're very ambitious. We're A-type personalities over at Phoenix and we want to do a lot. And like anytime someone says you can't do something, we're like, yes, we can do both. And there's always like sometimes a limit of like, hey, what are those like really hard trade-offs? And so we have to say, hey, just not now for those things. And there may be absolutely a potential where we just end up partnering with some companies to be able to get those types of products. Because a big part of it is they at least want one consumable API. Right. If the underwriting lender is another third party, fine. But they want to be able to have one API because it just simplifies their experience. It simplifies the capital management and the cash flow issues that can be tied up with that type of thing. So that's how we think about it.
Is there any framework, formula, just any, I guess, mental model that you use to define how to focus on, given that there's so many things you guys could be doing?
I don't know that there's a formula. I think in general, there's almost like never a formula for anything when it comes to startups, right? Like there are 100 different ways to build a company and there's no perfect way to do it. And a lot of that formula changes depending on the type of people that you have. You can't run the same strategy if you have like a different type of culture or team structure or specializations.
Let's say you're in your, I'm not sure if it's monthly or quarterly meeting with your, C-level, and you're discussing, hey guys, this customer wants us to open the UK or Australia, but there's this other customer is asking us for this new product. I guess, what are the type of questions you guys talk about what's happening in your head to make that decision?
Usually we'll kind of enumerate what all those options are. And then we'll think about what is the actual capital required for each of those? And then what's the actual length of time? And then the last part is like, what are the unknowns? Like, what are the things that we're like, we're pretty sure that's more complicated than we think it is because someone has told us that they got burned by that before.
Okay. Keep going back to history.
Yeah. So it goes back to history. There's a lot of people that oftentimes want to help you, right? They want to help other founders. Like people do like sharing their experiences and people like to share the bad experiences that they had as well. So if you go to like, you know, three or four people who you know in your network who have gone live in the UK and you call them all up and be like, hey, what am I missing here? Because there's like, our assumption, and I try to teach everybody at Phoenix this, is like only the paranoid survive. There is a landmine that's there. You just don't know it yet, right? We just haven't found it out. We just got to figure it out as soon as possible or prepare for it. And so when you talk to other folks who've, you know, tried something that you've done and they failed at it, they can usually give you lessons. Oh, well, you didn't know is that you're going to have like, you know, a multi-million dollar reserve. You're going to have to hire this many people here, here, and here. It can take anywhere from 6 to even maybe 18 months. And they're in the middle of changing all the rules and regulations. Ooh, that might not be the thing that we want to do. Those data points are very important to understand like, hey, what are the constraints that you do have? If you're fundraising the next X number of months, is that going to actually help you with that, you know, fundraising story? Or is there something else that will give you
great?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think those are the parts that are really important to kind of think about as well.
Do you, I guess, ever think about, like, speaking of those hidden costs, do you ever think about the loss of focus? Mm-hmm. Because there's, I mean, let's say you have some amount of focus in your team and you're doing one thing, you're focusing 100% of that amount.
Yeah.
When you have two things, mm-hmm. it's not really 50%, 50%. There's some percentage that is lost in the process of changing projects, right? I guess, how do you factor that in your thought process?
I think one of the things that I've heard a lot of folks try to do, especially when they're trying to do multiple things, is like they'll hire more teams to do that. Sometimes it actually makes it even harder because now you have five people who have one idea and it's broken up across all five, and the mental coordination and the meetings is context switching is insane. So I think a big part of that, of figuring out how to do multiple things at once, comes down to your operating cadence as a team. And it comes down to like the basic processes that you have across your entire organization. So one thing that we do is that we've tried probably every single, you know, project management tracker that's out there. And we actually ended up just using now Google Sheets. Straight up, we've tried it all. And so we have this now very like templatized Google Sheet that we share with everyone, from product to new country rollouts, to new special projects that we have, to the marketing project initiatives. And a big part of that is like forcing the weekly review of this item and going through every single line item, just checkmark by checkmark, and making sure that everybody has like a command over all of their individual initiatives.
Okay.
And so the critical part is making sure that everything is in that doc and that you are reviewing it, because inevitably there will be trade-offs that happen. And so if a trade-off comes up, hey, we have to work on this new thing. There's a new compliance regulation that came out that can have an impact to everybody else's work streams and dependencies as well. And so being able to communicate out to everybody else to kind of reorient the team comes down to a very like disciplined, rigorous project management process. Is it possible to do? Yes. Does it take a lot of time and coordination and very disciplined leaders and project managers? Absolutely. Like the attention to detail to it is very hard. But there are certain industries where you have to be able to like spin five plates up at once, or you'll never get anything off the ground, right? Like you have limited capital to catch up to some big players in your space. And so being, you know, taking all of those contexts into account, sometimes there's no other like solution.
Yeah, I love that, because the conventional startup advice is focus on one thing. Like, and I think at some point in the growth of the company, that stops being the case, right? Especially if you want to build, I guess, a multi-billion dollar company, you'll inevitably have multiple products. So you have to do many things at once.
It's
like a new muscle, because I mean, right from the start, everyone told you just focus on one thing. And then it's like changing, I guess, like the, I'm not sure if mindset or way in which you work to fit this new model.
Well, one of our investors, Charles Hudson from Precursor, had this thing that stuck with me for a while, that there are certain industries where you can have 50% of the product and you can sell it repeatedly. There are other industries where you can have 65%, not good enough. All right, 75%, not enough. 90%, not enough. 98% of the product feature set has to be there for you to build that like repeatable sales motion. Payments is one of those things, right? If we don't have Apple Pay or Google Pay on the web, or we don't have Apple Pay or Google Pay on your mobile phone, people won't buy it, right? They won't use you. There's like just easy disqualifications that are there. So you have to be able to build a very comprehensive product suite. You have to be able to juggle multiple feature sets and product spaces, and you have to get them to all play well together very nice. And so it's very hard, and very few people are really great at doing it. People can learn it, but it is hard to be able to do. And we spend a lot of time teaching people, hey, this is how we do product and project management here at Phoenix. And we spend a lot of time thinking and iterating on, why didn't that work? How do we tweak that process? How do we tweak how we work to optimize for that? When it works, it kind of feels like magic.
It sounds like that comfort working with multiple projects is like a cultural core competency of Phoenix. How do you filter that when hiring?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Just a fine comment. Sounds like a lot like a consulting profile of a.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. I mean, as a kid, I was like one of those kids who had like a messy binder and papers all over, and like I was never very organized. Like, you know, you have those kids who have their binders completely clean. That was not me. I've had to train myself to be able to do that type of structure, and that's why I say it is something that can be learned. It is something that can be taught, but you have to be disciplined about it. I think oftentimes, you know, when you see in tech people will ask, like, how do you win? What's your silver bullet? But the reality is, like, there's very few silver bullets that are there. You look at a company like Amazon, one of the most valuable companies in the entire world. They don't have a silver bullet feature or product. They have a marketplace, a website, logistics management, infrastructure, and it's the weaving together of all these features that builds that differentiation. And that's probably, in most instances, how business actually operates. In terms of like, how do we hire for those people? I don't think that everybody can be that way, right? When you think about one of the things that seems super obvious now and is really critical that I've kind of like developed or learned over the last years is that running a company is really building and running a team, right? When you think about a sports team, you can't have every single person with the exact same skill set. If you had a basketball team and everybody was a center, you'd be a real shit basketball team, right? And so you have to understand who can dribble, who can be down low, who is good at defense, who are good shooters, and think about all those skill sets. They have to be able to play very well together. And so understanding who on your team are really good project managers and have that level of attention to detail that will go through that process and make sure to hold people accountable to their deadlines, because their deadline is in a critical dependency on somebody else's work. That's like making sure that those people are in those roles, right? Making sure that you have the designers, the backend engineers, the front end engineers, making sure that you have someone who can be that coordinator of all these roles is really critical. So I think it comes down to, does the role need it? Does that team lead need it? The managers have to have it, right? And they have to be very disciplined in those areas as well.
I love that. Let's jump into the last section of the interview. And I would love to talk about how will payments impact the software industry itself, mm-hmm. because it sounds like it's getting closer. I mean, there's multiple examples of companies that have built multi-billion dollar businesses by combining these two mm-hmm. pieces of products that seem to be separate. And to start, I'd love to talk about this thing I've heard you talk about multiple times, which is, what if we build the AWS of fintech? Mm-hmm. What does that entail? Mm-hmm. I guess, what are the main roadblocks or challenges for Phoenix to become that Amazon Web Services of fintech?
Yeah, I think one of the things that AWS did incredibly well is that they made it so easy for you to build and scale a website or a web app, right? And so when you think about how you can launch any type of website or a web app and you apply that to financial services, we should be able to make it as easy as possible for anybody to launch any type of payment product, payment experience. And they should be able to do it using a suite of APIs that keep them compliant. And so they don't have to hire armies of engineers to be able to do this, right? Like back in the day, you would have, to manage your own server farms, your own databases, you have to hire specializations around DevOps engineers. Like, it's very hard to do that. And then people later said, hey, I could do it. I'm not going to. I'm going to outsource it to the folks who are those experts. And I think it's very similar to folks here in the payments world. Even large payment companies or large SaaS companies who built their own payments infrastructure are now coming to us saying, hey, we spent, tens of millions of dollars doing this, and it's not a set it and forget it model. There's constant updates and constant innovation, maintaining the compliance of these systems, adding new feature functionality. There's new payment acceptance methods. There's new devices. We'd rather outsource that to you.
I love that, because that stems from the insight that payments is a differentiator itself. Otherwise, you would just build it and set it up. But if it's a core competency to your business, then you actually need to be working on it.
I mean, think about Uber, Airbnb. They're two perfect examples of what was critical to their success was without a doubt payments, right? I don't know if you guys remember using VRBO and HomeAway, which were early competitors to Airbnb. But I remember, booking locations and things like that. And then you would have to mail them a check.
Wow.
And you always felt like you're going to get defrauded. You're like, this can't be real. Like, you're telling me I'm going to send you $1,000 cashier's check in the mail? And this ain't be good, right? That inherent trust in the seamlessness of the payments experience was critical to creating that form of safety and security of you willing to go into some stranger's house.
That's fascinating. It's like GPS for Uber. Like, you needed that core piece of infrastructure for that experience to work.
And payments too.
Yeah.
Right.
It's as important as payment. That's my point. Uh-huh.
I remember this is back in 2010 and before. Like, you'd take a cab anywhere on the East Coast, and their payment systems never worked for the cab. It was always broken. It wasn't that it was really broken. They just wanted to accept cash. They didn't want to take your credit card. And so there was always this weird experience of you going back and forth. Is it really broken? I don't have any cash. right? And it was just like, it was an awful experience. Now you hop out of an Uber, you don't even think about it, right? You just call someone up. Like, the experience is so seamless, so much so that now if you probably are in a cab, you probably hop out of it. I've had this happen before where now I hop out and the cab driver is like, hey, you forgot to pay me. You're like, oh my God, I totally forgot.
Yeah, yeah. Right? It's happened to me when I go out of the US.
Oh yeah. The receipts, the invoicing, like, you know, all that kind of stuff like that that happens is just, it's just a different experience, and payments is a critical part of that. In fact, we had a few folks who came from Uber's payments team early on over at Phoenix, and they shared that like the biggest blocker for them going into each country wasn't setting up the local operations, was how could they accept payments in that market?
So going back to the AWS question, like, what are the main challenges, roadblocks preventing Phoenix from becoming that, I mean, operating system AWS for fintech?
I would say like 2 years ago, it was all about whether or not we were a processor. And so when we talk about building the operating system for fintech, we actually have this graphic and this visualization that kind of shows what does a typical operating system look like. And there's typically levels to that ecosystem as well. There's the user, there's the app, there's the operating system, and there's the hardware. So if we use a real world example, think about Uber. There's the user layer there, is the driver and the rider. The app is Uber. The operating system is Android. And then you have your actual like Galaxy phone or whatever have you, right? And so in our world for fintech, the users are the buyers and the sellers, right? The apps are not actually Phoenix. It's the vertical SaaS companies that are empowering them. And then they're building their payments experiences on top of our suite of APIs. We're also connecting into hardware. But even more importantly than that, we're connecting to this incredibly disparate world of financial services. We're creating, connecting to the credit card networks. We're connecting into the local banking networks. We're connecting into alternative payment methods. We're connecting into the transactional fraud monitoring systems, into all the compliance bodies to make all of this consumable. So those are the parts that we focus a lot of time on, is how do we build the connections into this like really disparate, antiquated world, and do it in a way that's very seamless for our customers and abstracts away the complexity of compliance from them.
And becoming a payment processor was a big step.
Yeah, because before that, we had another layer of like legacy infrastructure that we had to build around that limited the types of businesses that we could support, the fund flows, the uptime and availability. And so now we can go directly to that source.
Earlier, you were describing the amount of investment, insurance, deposits that you required to become a payment processor. So I imagine that took probably a couple of years to become a reality.
Oh, I mean, more than a decade, okay. I guess, right?
Like, I wonder, since in the future, I mean, in the roadmap of Phoenix, there's a new challenge as big as that, as becoming a payment processor itself. Is there like a stepping stone that you guys have to start? Are you thinking about working today, which is that is as big as that, or everything that comes afterwards is much easier than becoming a payment processor?
Every part of a startup is hard, right? And I think one of the things that one of our earliest investors from Homebrew said to me early on was, you know, your life is always going to be hard. It's just different types of hard. So it doesn't get any easier. It's just like a different type of hard. The processor element was like one massive milestone that absolutely unlocks a tremendous amount of opportunity and benefits for both Phoenix and, for more importantly, for our customers. Mm-hmm. I think the next big problem that we really have to continue to be very mindful of is how to navigate the unique compliance and frameworks of every country that we enter into. So we're going live in Canada this month. It'll be some press, but by the time this gets released, we will already have like made that announcement. And so don't leak it. But the compliance and underwriting rules that dictate the US are different from the compliance and underwriting rules that dictate Canada. In terms of what information we can collect, in what information we can't collect, how we report out to our customers, what the terms of services look like. Each one of them is dictated by a different body. And so how do you build a product that can seamlessly cover both of those countries? Yeah, and be thoughtful about adding these new forms of payment methods. That's very difficult. And we've been thoughtful about that for years. And so we're excited about how fast we were able to stand up this new country. And we're excited about the new ones that will come down the line. And so, but still, like, there's a lot of unknowns that are around the corner. And so it just really comes down to how we'll navigate those.
New hearts.
Yeah. I mean, I think we always try to teach everybody at Phoenix that's part of the startup process is navigating these unknowns. And that's the fun part that keeps you like on your toes. And if it was easy, everybody else would be doing it.
If Phoenix becomes the AWS of fintech,
when
Phoenix becomes the AWS of fintechs, in this new world, most software companies will probably make it a bulk of the revenue out of payments and financial services.
Yeah.
How do you think that changes the business model of software itself? Like, does the software just become like an excuse to own the payments, an entry point into the financial services of a business? I mean, will software prices tend to zero in that world?
It could. And we've seen that happen today. I think it really depends on the industry. Depends on the industry. It depends on the country and the region. It depends on, for that sector, you know, what is the price sensitivity of their merchants? There's a lot of different factors. So it's not a sort of cookie cutter approach to each of these.
Yeah. Even, I mean, Toast, I imagine they subsidize at some point, at some level, their hardware just to grab the payments from the restaurant.
Yes. And their hardware is also very sticky as well, right? Because like if you have that hardware out there and the restaurants are using it, yeah, it's going to be there for years, right? And so that is, I guess it's kind of like the razor blade example, right? When it comes to you know, software companies making a portion or a significant portion of their revenue from payments, it's already happening today. And it's not just software companies. One of my favorite stories, and you can look this up, there was a New York Times article about this, is that Macy's makes 41% of their bottom line from their credit cards.
Wow.
It's wild. Like you think about them as being this like mass, yeah, as a retailer, but now it's a credit card company. And so there are so many other stories and industries that this is already happening. We talked about Toast, who gives away the software for free. I think the other parts are a critical part of their go-to-market strategy. It's a critical part of their channel distribution. And so the software is very sticky as well. It's the coupling of those two things that creates a differentiated product. One or the other isn't necessarily something that I think is going to be a winning proposition in a lot of these sectors long term.
When software providers can start facilitating payments right from the start, because what you're basically doing is making it as easier as possible. As you said, like you can, I mean, I guess it's, in the past, you needed a company of a specific size to be able to use AWS.
Yeah.
The product grew and the business model changed to a point in which a one-person startup can use AWS. You guys are doing the same for Phoenix. Like you can probably start, and I've read up some of the other.
Oh yeah, we have startups with like two people using us, absolutely.
Okay. But at the beginning, I think you were focusing on slightly bigger companies, but then you made a product like a simpler, I mean, change the business model in a way. So startups can start thinking about payments from the get-go. How do you think that changes the way in which software is built itself? Like how does that influence the roadmap of a software founder?
Yeah, great question. So our DNA and where we came from was actually previously from a payment startup that only sold to startups. So selling to the enterprise was actually probably something that was more foreign to us. And if anything, I think it actually led to some really incredible product development decisions because we were able to bring that same level of developer-friendly APIs, that same attention to detail to our developer docs, the same appreciation for how simple we should be able to make it for our customers, the fact that we should be the ones eating the complexity, not our customers, and thinking about how you could take that and apply it to the configurability that our customers wanted. So when folks look at our developer docs and look at our APIs, there, like we actually, someone posted like a tweet that we had on like a New York Times billboard because like how great our developer docs were. And that felt incredible. I wrote the original developer docs and spent a lot of time on them. And we deeply believe that is a part of our product experience. I don't run it now, but we still take that same level of appreciation and think thoughtfulness that this is the product experience. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting part was that when we started off with that segment, what we realized is that actually, for a lot of large enterprises, they don't get engineering resources for back office tools and solutions, right? They like if they need to build reporting, sorry, they only use those engineers for product facing features. And so it actually encouraged us to bring in product designers to work on a lot of the the low code and no code solutions. And so now we have the benefit of having these like powerful APIs and a suite of no-code solutions that now enable smaller startups to get up and running even faster. And so there's actually been this sort of like intersection and trend where everything was developer first, and now developers are saying, hey, I could code those things up. Can you just give me some low-code solutions so I can just like prove, you know, do a proof of concept, get up and running? And then later on, if I want more control, I can integrate into those APIs. And so I think that there was sort of this confluence of happy accidents that actually resulted in something that is mutually beneficial to both parties. One of our product managers shared that when they thought about our product, it's kind of like a DSLR camera, right? You know, those like really like powerful cameras where it's so easy that you can do point and click shoot, or you can actually tweak all of the
You can make it as hard as you want.
Yeah. So it's like, hey, for the experts, it's available, but for the most people are just going to use that point and click. And so you don't have to sacrifice the configurability for the ease of use.
Before, you were talking about the type of products that require, where 40%, 50% is not enough. Then you need 98% to actually make revenue. Mm-hmm. Do you think software or payments are going towards that direction where, I know, an SMB, a restaurant, a gym, a spa is going to say, sorry, if my software doesn't have payments, I don't want it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Here in the US, it's almost becoming, you know, standard out of the box expected solution, right? Like you want the package to roll out, download, or like not download, you're not downloading any software anymore. You pull up your browser, start accepting payments, and it all works out of the box. If you go anywhere internationally, that connection of software and payments does not exist today. And it's so obvious that it's a secular trend that will take over in these markets because the product experience is so much better. Like it's not till you see the alternative and you feel the alternative and you're watching and you're waiting for that person to take out their calculator, get the menu, add tax. If you're international and you have a US-based card, then they're doing the currency conversions in front of you. They're showing you the final amount. They're tying it in and they're bringing it to you. Like it takes so much time and so much complexity to do that. So I think we can all agree that that's really where the world is going to go. It's just a matter of time for people to see that it's, you know, the standard.
It's like, I guess, opening a Shopify store and then having to go to another provider.
Yeah.
Hey, give me payments, please, to my Shopify store.
Right? Yeah. I mean, most people don't end up starting, you know, a lot of like small businesses and you do it only like once. And so when you do it, though, you're like, wait, why is this so complicated? Why is this so complex?
So I'd like to have some last closing questions. I was listening to this, the famous All In podcast, which you've probably heard. Last week, making a prediction, which was vertical SaaS will be the biggest loser of 2024, because thanks to Gen AI, companies can easily build highly personalized tools internally. Would you agree?
No.
How is this related to the shift in business model you're seeing?
I always love these predictions because, I mean, when you speak to all your VC buddies and friends who do this type of thing, they'll all tell you like, yeah, we just say controversial stuff so that people will retweet it. And so they don't even go back and look at like if any of their predictions were right. They just want to say it so they can be like top of mind and like people can talk about it. And so I guess it worked, right? We're talking about it. We're talking about it. But if you've used a lot of ChatGPT and I use it quite frequently, I was, you know, very much a pessimist around it. And I don't use it to like Google specific answers, but I still use it for like coding support. And so kind of like the Copilot type of stuff. And for that, it's incredibly powerful. It is significantly, in my opinion, better than Stack Overflow. Because you use Stack Overflow, you're like, hey, I have this problem. And then they have like 20 different answers and you're trying to figure out which is the actual right answer and you're testing it. There's actually a like way higher degree of fidelity of like accurate answers, it feels like, when you're using ChatGPT for some of these things as well. Now, that said, if you don't know how to code, I don't know how it's going to help you all that much, right? You can ask it to try to build some of these like low code solutions, but you still have to tweak it, test it. You have to understand what a number of these like key concepts are too, right? How do you install a Python library? How do you, you know, just basic things. Like you have to know how to ask it these technical questions. And now when it comes to the vertical SaaS person, is the vertical SaaS owner, the restaurant owner in this example, going to go to ChatGPT and say, hey, can you build me an ordering system?
Yeah, they won't. Yeah. Like, but yeah. Do you think that might happen, I guess, at an enterprise level where enterprises start building these vertical tools themselves? Because I understand the smaller businesses probably don't have the engineering teams to do that.
I mean, these enterprise companies still have to build scalable solutions and offerings, right? There's still, even things like Zapier and these type of like connector type apps, you still have to have some degree of engineering background and understanding to know how do you send a payload? What is a webhook? How do these things all connect together? So I think, you know, when you actually look at it from a practical perspective, will it enable people to build better internal tooling? Yeah, it'll enable them to do it faster, but you still have to probably have the engineers who know how to do these things and stitch them together. You know, you can probably build a little toy dummy app, but are you going to be able to build this enterprise grade solution that you're going to trust from a security perspective, from a compliance perspective, that you're going to roll out to your customers? I don't know. I'm very skeptical.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Last closing question. If we were to travel 10 years into the future, what would be the most extraordinary vision of what Phoenix has become?
Thought about this for a very long time. I mean, the dream is to be able to go anywhere around the world and have a non-zero chance that a big part of that economic activity is going through something Phoenix built, right? Like, no one needs to know who we are. Like, that's one of the cool parts about being in payments is, like, we're invisible to most people. But to know, like, where we started and to know that now we process tens of billions of dollars all around the world, to go to, like, a local shop and know, hey, our payment system is a part of that, it's one of the most gratifying, cool feelings in the world to see that kind of level of scale. And so to do that on a, like, even bigger scale, that's really cool and really exciting. And I think that's some of the things that like really geek us out when we see those usage and utilization rates and, you know, the number of API calls that are coming to our system. Like, we did that. You know, our team did that. That was, you know, countless hours of blood, sweat, and tears, years, and people will never appreciate it, but we appreciate it. So that's something that is incredibly gratifying.
Yeah. I wonder, did you always have such a big vision or like right from the start, or was it a consequence of all that you guys have been through at Phoenix, or was there a point in which you realized, okay, this actually can be possible?
I think that in general, since I was a little kid, had a bigger vision than like what was, I guess, like around me, right? Like, just, you know, very optimistic and very ambitious. And so I think part of that came from like my parents. So my parents were undocumented immigrants. They came from Mexico back in the 60s and 70s, and they were always incredibly supportive. And they were always like hustling for me to be able to achieve other things. And so whether like the city where I grew up in is in Santa Ana down in Orange County, it's 80% Mexican immigrants, but our public schools are some of the worst in the state of California. And so my mom, for example, knew that the neighboring city 20 minutes away had the best public schools. And it was like Irvine High School, which is like the second safest city in all of America. Couldn't be two different like types of worlds. And my mom was the type of person who said, I want my son to go there. And so she walked into
Taipei.
Yeah, she's a hustler, right? No one taught her to do that, but she had those aspirations and expectations that I should be able to go there. And so she went to each one of them and got rejected from three schools, and the fourth one said yes, and I went there, and you see that, you know, my dad's a bus driver, and I used to take the bus to school, that like one short bus stop away, or a few bus stops, is a completely different world. And so that was eye-opening, that was inspiring in a lot of ways of what is possible. And then I got, you know, lucky enough to go to one of the greatest colleges in the world. As the first one to go to college, I got to go to Harvard. And you end up seeing what people were capable of there. And they weren't any smarter than a lot of the folks. That, like, yeah, are people kind of smarter than above average at taking tests? Sure. But it wasn't like, oh my God, these are next level geniuses that are out there. We're all capable of these things. It just comes down to, do you have that like vision and ambition, and are you willing to put in the time to catch up to be able to do that and achieve that? And you see, you know, folks who go on to build incredible companies, start incredible venture capital firms. And, you know, I think that opened up what that vision could be. Move out of Silicon Valley, same thing over and over again, right? Same sort of story of, whoa, I now know these people. I've seen people build these multi-billion dollar companies. Is it incredibly hard? Yes, but is it possible? Absolutely.
Do you ever think about the counterfactual? Let's say
you wouldn't have had the chance to stay on the bus to a few more stops so you can get to that other school. Mm-hmm. And I guess, if so, how does that affect the way in which, I mean, you lead people, you treat others, etc.?
Oh, would it have changed? Did it change my life? 1,000%. Absolutely. I have a lot of family members, cousins who didn't get the type of opportunity, and we grew up a few blocks away from each other. So you have these types of like diverging life experiences. And so I think, and because of that luck, right? I didn't really do anything to have my mom be my mom, right? And because of that understanding and appreciation for that luck, I try to take advantage of every minute that I get, right? I try to take every advantage of an opportunity that we have in front of us to go and do what we do at Phoenix, to go and try to help other founders who want to do their thing. So it's not lost on me, for sure.
Richie, thanks so much for that. I really appreciated this conversation, and I think it's a great place as an energy to finish the podcast. Thanks for that. And hope to have you in a future episode in a few years. When
10 years, we'll see what happens. Let's see what our predictions come back.
In this case, you have actually power over the prediction. So it's probably going to be much more precise than your one.
There you go.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.